Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Carol Bogert, Associate Director with Human Rights Watch, who examines charges that U.S. soldiers abused and tortured Iraqi detainees during interrogations at Abu Ghraib and other prisons in Iraq. Former counsel to President Richard Nixon and author John Dean, who explains why he believes the scandals and secrecy surrounding the Bush administration are more dangerous than those of the Watergate era. And Bruce Ackerman, professor of law and political science at Yale University, who discusses a proposal that could allow voters to cast a ballot for Ralph Nader without bolstering the chances of George Bush's re-election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
An investigation by the Associated Press has discovered that the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Asset Control, the agency in charge of blocking the flow of money to terrorist groups, appears to be obsessed with Fidel Castro. By the end of 2003, the Bureau had 21 agents working to enforce the economic blockade against Cuba, while only four agents were searching for the financial assets of Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. From 1990 to 2003, the agency only opened 93 investigations relating to terrorism and collected less than $10,000 in fines. In contrast, it opened nearly 11,000 cases for violating the Cuba embargo and collected more than $8 million in fines. North Dakota Senator Byron Dorgan called the revelations astounding and pledged to start a drive in Congress to cut off the agency's funds if more effort is not made to track down the flow of money to Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda terrorist network. In light of congressional criticism of the Treasury Department's anti-terror effort, Treasury Secretary John Snow is consolidating several financial investigative agencies under the control of the new Undersecretary for the Office of Terrorism and Financial Intelligence. The Bush administration, in its new budget request, wants to double the budget for asset seizure from what it was 4 years ago. Brazil's Landless Workers Movement, or MST, has once again started seizing vacant land to force the hand of President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva to step up the pace of land reform. In 2003, Lula's government only resettled 14,000 out of the 4 million landless families hoping for resettlement. The latest round of land takeovers began on April 17th, the eighth anniversary of the El Dorado de Carajas massacre, in which police killed 19 peasant activists who were occupying unused land. During the MST offensive, 400 landless families invaded land owned by Klabin, Brazil's biggest paper producer. This seizure has alarmed business interests because the land is in productive use and generating foreign currency for the struggling Brazilian economy. Lula insists that land reform must take place within the law. However, in what appears to be a response to the protest, the government has promised to settle 400,000 landless families by 2006 and 115,000 families by the end of the year. MST claims its aggressive tactics are legal, as Brazil's 1988 constitution states that vacant and unproductive land can be appropriated by the government. Luiz Marco Suplicy Hafers, former president of Brazil's largest farmers group and a large landowner, says he's basically opposed to the MST land invasions, but that agricultural reform is essential, that those living in Brazil's countryside today are destitute, socially excluded, and living in extreme poverty. According to the Denver Post, at least 37 female soldiers have sought sexual trauma counseling and other assistance from civilian rape crisis groups after returning from duty in Iraq, Kuwait, and Afghanistan. The women who rank from enlisted soldiers to officers complain of poor medical treatment, lack of counseling, and lax criminal investigations by military officials. Many women have remained silent out of fear of humiliation or official retaliation. In February, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld called for a full-scale investigation of sexual assaults on female soldiers. At the time, the Pentagon confirmed that 88 cases of sexual misconduct were reported from troops in Iraq, Kuwait, and Afghanistan. A sexual assault scandal rocked the Navy in 1991 when dozens of women were mauled by 100 officers at the Tailhook Convention in Las Vegas. No officer has yet been convicted of a crime. Today, victims of sexual assault say they are not respected by the military brass. Danielle, a 23-year-old officer, was attacked and raped after she got off guard duty at 2:30 in the morning in Kuwait. However, her unit did not provide any counseling for sexual assault, and she was requested to take a lie detector test. Later, she stated, "I feel the chain of command betrayed me. I gave 4 years to that unit, and I feel they kicked me in the teeth when I was down." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
As combat between U.S. troops and insurgents continue throughout Iraq, world attention has been focused on photos of American prison guards abusing and sexually humiliating their Iraqi prisoners. The international scandal erupted after investigative reporter Seymour Hersh wrote a lengthy article about the torture allegations in the New Yorker magazine and a U.S. soldier's decision to hand over digital images capturing the mistreatment to Army investigators. These pictures were later broadcast on CBS TV's 60 Minutes 2 program on April 28th. Since then, Congress has undertaken an investigation into who was responsible for the abuse and why information about the alleged torture was not investigated or acted upon sooner. The International Committee of the Red Cross has issued a report that states that documentation on the abuse of prisoners was collected by inspectors who visited U.S.-run prisons in Iraq as early as May 2003. The Red Cross maintains that it had regularly informed American prison administrators of the conditions found during site visits, with complaints being directly reported to top Bush administration officials in mid-January of this year. The Red Cross report quotes coalition intelligence officers as estimating that 70 to 90% of Iraqi detainees were arrested by mistake. Thus far, the Pentagon has filed criminal charges against 7 U.S. soldiers for their alleged mistreatment of Iraqi prisoners. While many Democrats have called for the resignation of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, President Bush continues to publicly support the secretary. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Carol Bogert, Associate Director with Human Rights Watch, who examines the charges against U.S. soldiers, accountability up the chain of command, and American adherence to the Geneva Conventions.
Well, I think it's important to understand that this is not the action of a few rogue soldiers, that this isn't just a couple of bad apples in a U.S. military that is, you know, otherwise squeaky clean. That's not to say that every serviceman or woman in Iraq is guilty of this kind of thing, not at all. But it was a much more systemic problem than I think the leadership at the Department of Defense and in the White House would have us believe. The first really credible reports of torture surfaced in a Washington Post piece on, I think it was Christmas Day, actually, of 2002, about also the rendition of suspects, the handing over of suspects to countries that torture, as well as torture at the hands of U.S. officials themselves. Now, both of those things are illegal under the International Convention Against Torture, so they were both of great concern to human rights groups. We wrote to the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz, in January of 2003, urging that the administration should publicly state that torture would not be tolerated. So the fact that this was happening was known by the pieces in the Washington Post and was raised as a problem by human rights groups, almost a year and a half ago. So we know that the U.S. military did begin a criminal investigation into the death of an Afghan man who was in U.S. custody in December, and that there were other credible reports of torture in Afghanistan. Again, this is not a problem that is limited to Iraq. What we were able to document in Afghanistan is that we have a major problem at the Bagram base there, as well as other parts of, what is appropriately being described as the American Gulag, a series of detention facilities, who knows where, where the Bush administration has attempted to argue that essentially international law does not apply. And the Geneva Conventions aren't in effect. These aren't prisoners of war. And stress and duress techniques that were officially and formally adopted in the Department of Defense have been in play for quite some time. So it's not a new problem, and it's not something that the leadership in the Department of Defense or of the U.S. government should have learned about just since the publication of these photographs.
It seems that the Bush administration is putting forward this notion of exceptionalism, where the United States doesn't have to comply with international laws that have been on the books for decades. And we also have the case where the Bush administration opted out of the International Criminal Court and made side deals with nations all over the world to make sure that U.S. personnel were exempt from any kind of prosecution of war crimes. Tell us a little bit about what the Bush administration has done in the instances of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and how that erodes international law.
The refusal to apply the Geneva Conventions to prisoners whom we picked up in conflict, the refusal, as you mentioned, to not just to ratify the International Criminal Court Treaty, but actually to unsign a treaty that Clinton had signed, which was an act unprecedented in U.S. diplomatic history. Combined with, I think, what goes beyond human rights issues into the field of, you know, the environment, Kyoto Treaty, biological weapons treaties, and other international initiatives, as well as just the United Nations itself. In fact, the very idea that there should be multilateral diplomacy has definitely been under threat and under siege from the Bush administration. And taken together, it's a powerful signal of American arrogance and American exceptionalism. I certainly would fault the Bush administration for that policy. But I have to say that I think the current scandal over the abuses in Abu Ghraib really challenge many Americans' sense of who they are and what Americans are capable of. And I think that many people have made the assumption that we Americans would never do something like that. That's not the kind of people we are. I think these photos have been very, very shocking to people on a kind of a personal level.
Well, just a final question, Carol, and that has to do with what in the minds of the folks over at Human Rights Watch should be done in terms of holding accountable the soldiers who actually committed the abuse, their superiors, and even the political leadership in Washington, including Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and the president himself.
Yeah, I think it's very important that people be held to account. We have the first court-martial that's been announced, I believe, for May 19th, and it's a special court-martial with the relatively weak punishments, even if the defendant is found guilty. Secretary Rumsfeld said before, when he testified in Congress, that he forgot to bring the chain of command documents that would have shown, you know, how this information should have gone up the chain. But these are very important facts that need to be unearthed. And the criminal investigations need really to be followed very, very carefully, because we're talking now about a welter of prison guards, private contractors, and other individuals who were immediately involved, and then their superiors up the chain. And I think it would behoove Secretary Rumsfeld to produce that chain of command document, and we better start looking at it pretty closely.
That was Carol Bogert, Associate Director with Human Rights Watch. Call the group at area code 212-290-4700 or visit their website at www.hrw.org. Over the past year, the Bush administration has struggled to regain its credibility with the public over issues such as Saddam Hussein's missing weapons of mass destruction, the now-debunked justification for the Iraq War, White House stonewalling in the September 11th Commission inquiry, and misrepresentations made about Mr. Bush's environmental and fiscal policies. But during this election year, the president has also been forced to confront a succession of administration insiders who have gone public with their accounts of secrecy and deceit that they say are standard practices within the Bush White House. Among these officials are former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark, former State Department Deputy Tom Mertens, resigned anti-terrorism advisor Rand Beers, former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, Greg Thielman, former aide to Secretary of State Colin Powell, and former Ambassador Joseph Wilson. Much like U.S. Defense Department analyst Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the now-famous Pentagon Papers about the Vietnam War to the press during the Nixon era, these Washington insiders have blown the whistle on what they see as government misconduct. John Dean, a former counsel to President Nixon, whose congressional testimony revealed to the nation the abuse of power and secrecy employed by his boss, has written a new book confronting the current occupant of the White House titled Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. Between the Lines Scott Harris spoke with John Dean about why he believes the scandals and secrecy surrounding President Bush are more dangerous than those that brought down Richard Nixon in 1974.
I don't like sound bites, but if I had a one-line sound bite to explain the book of what's worse, it's the fact that nobody died during Watergate. No, none of the Nixon abuses during Watergate per se resulted in anyone losing their life. That isn't the case with the secrecy of this presidency.
John Dean, what about the idea that the September 11th terrorist attacks in this country justifies the secrecy to protect the country, to protect government planning and so forth, and even justifies to some extent in the minds of those in the White House a curtailing of our civil liberties? How do you view that?
Well, there's no question that no president can govern in a fishbowl. The secrecy that caught my attention and started my antenna quivering started long before 9/11. What happened after 9/11 was they used 9/11 and the war on terrorism and national security as an excuse to further make things secret that need not be secret. In other words, they exaggerated the need, and this administration has, within the first early hours and actually weeks right after 9/11, they weren't exploiting, they were dealing with a situation. But somewhere soon after 9/11, the political people realized that this was a godsend for George Bush, and they have ever since exploited it politically. And what they have done is try to keep the terror in terrorism and to keep people as frightened as they can possibly be, because they find this is easier to govern. The polls indicate that much of the public believes Republicans are more competent than Democrats to govern in wartime. It's a myth I've never understood when you look at the history of the two parties as to who has actually been governing in some of the more dire war situations that we've done well in as a nation. But anyway, it's a popular belief politically right now. So they've exploited the war on terrorism, and they've used it for excuses to further their secrecy and to try to bury anything and everything they can. But it just doesn't fit. For example, the Energy Task Force, which is a subject that's right before the Supreme Court right now. And it's just absurd, the position they're taking, that the vice president and, by implication, the president, exist in some firmament that neither the courts nor the Congress can look at. It just doesn't fit with our concept of separation of powers and checks and balances.
John Dean, there are a lot of scandals brewing around this president, as you've covered in your book, and certainly new ones have arisen since. There's the Valerie Plame investigation that's ongoing about who leaked the identity of the CIA agent, the wife of a critic of the administration. Is it at all a possibility, you think, that is in 1972, where Richard Nixon, although the Watergate scandal happened before his reelection campaign, the real facts of the matter didn't come out until after he regained the presidency for his second term. Is there a possibility we're not going to see any kind of smoking gun for this president in the scandals that are unfolding until after the November election?
Very good possibility that could happen. As you know from the book, I talk about some 11 different potential scandals that are in various stages of unfolding, everything from the Valerie Plame scandal to investigations of Cheney. They run a pretty wide gamut, and any one of those could erupt at any time. But not unlike Watergate, which occurred during the 72 campaign, the news media really ignored Watergate until it fell out in their lap. And then for about 30 years after that, they were extremely vigilant. But investigative reporting has come down to there are only a handful of investigative reporters working still. The press gives the president the benefit of the doubt these days. And so it's very likely we could have a repeat cycle where if Mr. Bush is reelected, one or more of these scandals that are worse than Watergate could well erupt.
And just a final question. In your book, you said that the Bush administration frightens you. And I wonder, what is at stake in your mind for American democracy in this election, this November? If George W. Bush wins a second term in office, what are your concerns?
What I said that I found scary about this administration, and I'm not somebody who's easily scared by any presidency, and it was an issue I was wrestling with as to how to handle in the book. And about the time I was turning to that section, I happened to read an interview by recently retired General Tommy Franks, who'd been the head of Central Command. And Franks said, was asked in the interview, what is the worst case that people should be thinking about? And Franks was very, very candid, and he said, here's what troubles me. If we learn that a terrorist organization gets possession of a weapon of mass destruction, it could well result in the shredding of our Constitution and the end of democracy as we know it. Now, I'm not sure why Franks feels that way, but from my own knowledge of government, having seen contingency plans, having watched this administration exploit 9/11, having watched their zeal with which they have dealt with everything from civil liberties issues to their constant image-making and capitalizing politically on tragedy, watching all that, that's why I'm concerned that if that event happens, indeed, we could go to where we've only been once as a nation, and we were only there for 11 weeks, and that was during the Civil War when Lincoln became what scholars later euphemistically called a constitutional dictatorship. Well, Abraham Lincoln is one president. George Bush is not Abraham Lincoln. He's not in the same league, and that's what I find pretty scary.
That was John Dean, former counsel to President Richard Nixon and author of the book Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, published by Little Brown. American school children learn in civics class that voters don't cast ballots for presidential candidates, but rather select a set of 538 electors from the 50 states, who then determine the winner of the presidency. This is why a candidate can win the popular vote, but lose the election in the Electoral College, as happened in the 2000 presidential election between Al Gore and George Bush. But by the time students are old enough to vote, most of them have forgotten about how this part of our democracy works. With the presumed Democratic Party presidential candidate John Kerry taking ever more cautious and conservative positions, many progressive voters are wishing they could find a way to support Ralph Nader's independent presidential bid without increasing George W. Bush's chances for another 4 years in the White House. A Yale Law School professor recently wrote an op-ed article for the New York Times that proposes a novel solution. Bruce Ackerman, an authority in constitutional law and the Electoral College, has proposed that Nader name the same set of electors as John Kerry's on each state ballot where he'll be running. He maintains this would allow votes cast for Nader to be counted toward the Democratic candidate's electoral slate. A spokesperson for Nader's campaign said the candidate is considering Ackerman's proposal and investigating his legal options. Meanwhile, Oregon and Texas have recently rejected Ralph Nader's petition to get on the ballot in those states. The veteran consumer advocate says he will challenge the Texas ruling in court. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Professor Ackerman, who explains his Electoral College strategy proposal for Nader and the legal battles that might lie ahead.
My proposal is that when Ralph Nader or the Nader movement gets Nader on the ballot in one or another state, what they should do is say that the Nader electors are the very same electors who Senator Kerry and the Democratic Party have nominated for the state. That way, when someone votes on the Nader line, he will, in fact, be voting for the Kerry electors. So by adopting this tactic, the Nader movement will give voters a new degree of freedom. They'll be showing that they really prefer Ralph Nader, but as realists, that they will be voting for Kerry over President Bush in November.
It sounds very straightforward, but when I was talking to a friend, he said this sounds like proportional representation rather than winner-take-all, which is the system that we have. So how can this be?
It isn't proportional representation because really, what the people who would be voting on the Nader line would be voting for would be Kerry electors. The real question, of course, is whether this is constitutionally required, whether a state could reject Ralph Nader's electors if, on the ground that they are the same ones as Senator Kerry. There are statutes which can be interpreted in one way or another in many states of the union that would make this solution illegal under state law, but the fact of the matter is that the constitutional status of those laws is very uncertain. I think that they would be struck down by the Supreme Court of the United States, so that what, practically speaking, would have to be done for the Nader movement in the various states to follow this procedure, propose Kerry's electors on their petitions, have them signed, and then we would have to litigate all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States on an expedited basis. If Mr. Nader pursued this suggestion, there is an upside and a downside. The upside is that if the Supreme Court forced the states to accept these petitions, which I think they would do, he would get a lot more votes. The downside is he would spend a lot of time and energy having these petitions, and if the Supreme Court said that this was not an acceptable tactic, well, then he would be off the ballot. I've studied the precedents very carefully, I should say, and it's my considered opinion that the Supreme Court would uphold the right of Ralph Nader to say, well, you know, my best electors are those who are the same ones as Mr. Kerry's.
That's one question I had. How exactly are electors picked? And do they have to stick with the candidate who picks them?
Each political party nominates electors who indicate that they are willing to serve. In many states, the state will authorize the party to exact a pledge from the elector that he's going to vote for the candidate. However, the Supreme Court of the United States has never said that these pledges can be enforced by law. Never. And the Constitution really does protect the independence of these electors. So I see no constitutionally acceptable reason for any state to reject Ralph Nader's electors because they're not pledged to vote for Ralph Nader. There's also, of course, a First Amendment right by any political organization to choose an electoral strategy that makes most sense to them.
That was Bruce Ackerman, Yale University professor of law and political science. Read his op-ed piece titled Two for One Voting online at www.commondreams.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.